actually say a little word of introduction. All of you that have been in the program understand what a delight it is to learn with Rabbi Fink. I have very, very distinct memories. 30 years ago, arriving as a 19-year-old in Yeshivat HaMiftar, and the sheer encounter, the thrill of having the opportunity to learn with someone the scope of whose knowledge is something I had never encountered before, and although it's something that many of us aspire to, none of us achieved, but the very aspiration itself that one can master the sea of Talmud, the sea of Halakha, that somebody could achieve it, even if it couldn't be me, was an inspiration to many of us, and I'm sure to many of you. And as others said over lunch, it's just a great schus and a great resource to have him in our lives, and to have him at the other end of the phone for the question, for ourselves, for our families, for people that we now teach. To have access to him, to his kindness, to his generosity of his time and his knowledge in his very, very modest and underspoken way, is a great source of strength to all of us that have to go on. And I'm so pleased that over these years in Web Yeshiva he's been a tentpole around which we've been able to construct particularly this program and everything we've done, and so many students have flocked to what we're doing because of the opportunity to learn with Rabbi Fink. But I want to start by posing a question to you. When we were planning this week's learning to try to figure out, well, how could we cap 3 years of intensive learning of Halakha, you suggested these four topics that kind of hang together as I don't know, I guess we would say life cycle things, both because they're of interest, both because they're of importance, but also because they somehow, I guess, I don't know, maybe they're litmus tests in how to analyze a practical contemporary halachic topic. So I would invite you to just open with a word of reflection on how you go about thinking about that, about organizing a topic and a sugya hilchatit for teaching, and why you chose these topics and how they represent that. And
okay, just as a brief introduction, as you know, I think it's terribly important to go with the flow and do what everyone else does and think the way everyone else thinks. Instead of that, I think it's terribly important to base one's actions, to base one's opinions on the principal sources, beginning with Torah, Mishnah, Gemara, medieval authorities, the principal modern authorities, and so forth and so on. That's the way to decide what is correct and what is incorrect as far as behavior is concerned, and that's the way to establish what proper hashkafot, what proper attitudes are regarding contemporary issues. Now, as we're going to see when we go through this material on induced abortions, we're going to see that the material itself does not support many ideas and actions which are floating around out there in the Torah observant community. Let's look at the sources and see what they actually say. We begin with a verse in the Torah. The verse says, "V'chi yinatzu anashim." Two guys are fighting. You know, I've had a lot of experience teaching in boys' schools, and I've had a lot of experience teaching in girls' schools. The big difference between them is that in boys' schools, during the hafsaka, during the intermission between classes, the boys fight with each other. In girls' schools, when they're not in class, they talk. Boys fight. And that's what's happening here. Ki yinatsu anashim, two guys are fighting with each other. That's what they do. The nagfu isha hara, a pregnant woman was standing by innocently, and they struck her. V'yatzu yiladeya, her babies came out. Sounds like an abortion, doesn't it? V'lo yihi ason, but, Baruch Hashem, although she lost her pregnancy, lo yihi ason, although she lost her pregnancy, there was not an ason, it wasn't a disaster. And it was only an abortion. No disaster here. Well, in that case, anosh yanesh kasher yashit alav bala isha, in this case, the person who was harmed, the person who was injured, was of course not the woman, we don't care about her. The person who was harmed, the person who was injured, was the woman's husband. He lost the children. I mean, he was expecting to have children born who were going to work and bring income into the family, take care of him when he's an old man, and so forth and so on. The woman's husband has been harmed and injured, and he is going to need some compensation. That's assuming there was no ason, no disaster, only an abortion. Oh, on the other hand, im ason yihyeh, if it was disastrous, if it was not only an abortion, but also disastrous, v'natna nefesh tachas nefesh, then it's a capital case, a capital punishment, a life for a life. And so the perpetrator has to be executed.
How do we think when the fuck of that it was an abortion? Why not just an early delivery?
Well,
or maybe she was in her ninth month and it was induced labor.
Caused by the being struck by the guys who were fighting.
That could be induced labor.
Okay. So, oh, you mean maybe the babies are alive, you think?
Yeah. I don't know where in the puzzle
no.
That indicates that the
baby died. No. We will see plenty of evidence for that, but not right now. No. Before, yeah.
Sorry. How would indeed the fleshers when there's no intent
to
hit the other guy?
No, this we'll also talk about. But before we get into the details, before we get into the halachas that flow out of this verse, let me make a footnote. Control F11 to open up the footnote window for a moment. Here's a footnote.
I forgot to know that. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. the understanding of this verse is a subject of great controversy between them and us. They have their way of understanding the verse, and we have our rabbinic way of understanding the verse. Let me explain to you what I'm talking about. In the case of an ason, in the case of a disaster, then it's a capital case. So someone's going to get executed. There's going to be capital punishment here. Now the question arises, and this is a question which you alluded to, the question arises, who exactly died here? And the pasuk is not exactly clear on this issue. Is capital punishment being imposed because of taking the life of the fetus? Or is capital punishment being imposed for taking the life of the mother? Now, this is a big point of controversy between them and us. In the Septuaginta, in the Greek translation of the Bible, which became the foundation of Christian thinking, the Septuaginta is more or less a word-for-word translation from the Hebrew, but sometimes the Septuagint sometimes goes into length, and this is one of the verses where the Septuagint, the length of the translation is around 3-4 times the length of the original verse, and in the Septuagint it's perfectly clear that the death penalty is being imposed for destroying the life of the fetus. And that forms the basis of Christian thinking through the generations. On the other hand, we are going to see, presently, we are going to see that in rabbinic tradition, the death penalty is on the table only for killing the woman. We are presently going to see that there is no death penalty for destroying the fetus, and we're going to understand why that's true when we come to those sources.
Wasn't the Septuaginta written by the rabbis?
Oh.
He locked up a bunch of rabbis in a room, and they all translated.
Yeah, it says so in the Gemara.
Right. So yeah. How could it be a different? Like, the Rabbanim translated it differently specifically for them?
Yeah, the no. The Greek version of the Chumash, which you correctly refer to, was done by great rabbis. There are a few examples of those translations in the Gemara, and the specific examples of the Greek version mentioned in the Gemara do not appear in the versions of the Septuagint which are known today. The versions of the Septuagint which are known today are all the product of severe Christian editing, full of Christological references. The Septuagint which we have today is a Christian work. It's surely based on the original rabbinic work, but we do not have that original rabbinic text. Okay, now...
Not a single one of those examples in the Gemara appear in the Septuagint.
Correct, not a single one. Not a single one. Okay. Since I made the order, so I can change the order, right? let's look at Rashi. I chose Rashi because Rashi is probably the most important of the commentators, surely the most important of the commentators, and typically he represents the mainstream thinking of rabbinic interpretation. Surely in this case he represents the mainstream thinking of rabbinic interpretation. And he says, Imasonia, if there'll be a disaster, a catastrophe for which the death penalty is on the table, the isha, it's only killing the woman which calls for a death penalty decision. Killing the fetus, there is no possibility of death penalty. V'natata nefesh tachas nefesh, this verse says death penalty. Rabotenu chokim b'davar, the great rabbis of the Talmud disagree about what the halacha is here. The first opinion is yeshomrim nefesh mamish. Some rabbis hold that we're talking really about the death penalty for killing that woman. If the woman dies, then the death penalty, you know, then there are tons of other requirements. Assuming that a ton of other requirements are fulfilled, then the death penalty is on the table. Yesh omrim, the other opinion in the Gemara is, mamon, there is no death penalty whatsoever. When the verse in the Torah said a life for a life, it didn't mean capital punishment. When the verse said a life for a life, it meant monetary compensation. You injure someone, you harm someone, so yeah, you have to pay monetary compensation. And one could discuss endlessly about how to actually evaluate, how to figure out how many shekels to pay for compensation. Avalo nefesh mamish, according to the second opinion, it's not really a death penalty case. No possibility of death penalty. Why? Sha'amitkaven laharog etzer v'harag etzer patur mamisa. Because the halacha is well established that in order to have the death penalty, you need some intention to murder someone. If there was no intention to murder, he was aiming to kill person one, and he missed, and he accidentally killed person number two. He was intending to kill someone, but not the person who was the real victim. Well, it's a well-established halacha that if he did not intend to kill that victim, no death penalty. And that's exactly the story in the verse. There was no intention to kill this woman. It was just two guys fighting, and it happened by mistake, by accident. No, the women don't fight. Not in this religion.
They didn't have intention to kill each other either.
Correct. No intention to kill. Therefore, there cannot be a death penalty. Therefore, it must mean monetary compensation. Mishalem liyorshav. And if we're talking about financial compensation, who gets the money?
Thousands.
Of course, he gets the money. Kemosha haya nimka b'shuk. The way to evaluate. The way to evaluate the financial value of the life of the woman who was killed is you figure out how much she would sell for in the slave market, and now we know what her financial value is, and that's the amount that you have to pay for compensation for having taken her life. Now, of course, on the slave market, her value will depend largely on her anticipated productivity over whatever her expected lifespan is. Someone who would buy her as a slave would calculate in his mind, how much work can I expect out of this person over how many years? And that will determine the value of the slave. That's how you do it.
Also, how much she'd be worth or pregnant as opposed to not being pregnant?
No, there are a ton of considerations. And people who are in the slave business know all of these calculations. You know, like people in the real estate business know all the calculations that go into figuring out the value of a real estate property. So in the slave business, they knew about this. You know, I don't know about you guys. I'm, you know, one of these modern Western namby-pamby liberals. And I don't get along well with the idea of slavery. That's just a personal quirk I have. And people like me, who do not get along well with the idea of slavery, are confronted with a problem. Here, before our eyes, rabbinic sources are chock full of slavery. I mean, there's just tons of material about slavery in beginning with the Chumash, going all the way through here, Rashi, you name it, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, you name it, it's chock full of halachas governing, regulating slavery. And someone like me doesn't, what on earth am I supposed to do with all of that material? So someone like me is forced into the conclusion, that even though there is, in general, something fundamentally perverse and wrong about slavery, there could be some bizarre situations in which slavery might really be the best thing for someone. Perhaps there are some bizarre situations out there in the world where slavery is really a good idea. Well, if it's possible that those bizarre situations exist, if it's possible that there's a situation where slavery might actually be the best thing for someone, then of course it has to be regulated. Just because the Torah talks endlessly about polygamy doesn't necessarily mean that I, as a follower of Torah, have to be a supporter of polygamy. There might indeed be some unusual cases in which polygamy makes sense, in which case it has to be regulated. Think about Rav Kahana in the Gemara, for example, who had 100 wives. You think you have problems. He had 100 wives. Now, Rav Kahana, quite understandably, was a Kohen. Rav Kahana, he was a Kohen. And back in those days, there was starvation in the land. People were quite literally starving to death in large numbers every day. And one of the halachas is that the wife of a Kohen has access to the truma warehouses, the warehouses of food that contain truma. So by marrying 100 women, he was able to save their lives. You know, like there's some bizarre situations in which really it does make sense to support polygamy. So it has to be regulated, and there are plenty of regulations regarding that. So in any event, what we understand from Rashi is that, number one, there's no possibility of the death penalty, no possibility of retzach, no possibility of murder for taking the lives of the fetus. That's perfectly clear in Rashi. And of course, you're beginning to wonder, if so, how does Rav Moshe Feinstein on page 3 come to exactly the opposite conclusion? But we'll worry about Rav Moshe Feinstein when we get to him. According to Rashi, death penalty is off the table. Now, if you think about it for a moment, because in this particular case there was no intention. Now let's take this point, which is a very important point, one step further. The key issue which Rashi does not address, the key issue is, what is the halachic status of the fetus? Now, in simple terms, in simple words, what we're interested in is the fetus a person or is the fetus not a person? And if the fetus is not a person, at what point in time does the fetus become a person? Now these are terribly important questions. After all, a person can own property. Right? A person can own property. A liver cannot. A finger cannot. A person can own property.
But can a child own property?
But yeah, sure. Yeah, children can own property. No doubt about it. Persons, including children, can inherit. Right? If the father dies or someone dies, there could be an inheritance. Children can inherit. And if the child in turn dies, that estate will go to whoever the inheritors of the child are. Okay, a person is someone who can own property, can acquire property, perhaps not be able to sell the property. If the fetus is a person, maybe it can't sell property, but it can own and acquire property. What happens if you give a gift to an unborn baby? Give a gift to a fetus. Is that a valid halachic procedure? When the baby is eventually born, it'll belong to that baby, and you can't take it back. You can't change your mind after you give a gift. Is there such a thing as giving a gift to a fetus? Well, if the fetus is a person, the answer is yes. What about inheritance? What if the father dies during pregnancy? The father's property by inheritance goes to the children. Is this one of the children? Is the fetus going to get a share of the... Well, if the fetus is a person, then of course it's going to inherit. These are all very important questions. We want to know whether or not the fetus is a person. And
it doesn't have to be one answer for all categories.
Of course. Rabbis like to make distinctions. But if the fetus is not a person, then the death penalty for destroying the fetus is off the table. After all, there's no death penalty for cutting off someone's finger. There's no death penalty for removing someone's kidney. And if the fetus is not a person, then the only possibility we're left with is that the fetus is part of the mother, Yerech Imo, in the words of the Gemara, a part of the mother. The mother has a finger, she has a kidney, and she has a fetus. But none of these things, except the mother, none of these things are persons. Okay, let's go one step further in clarifying this idea. The Mechilta, as you know, there are two kinds of Midrash. There's Midrash Agadah, following primarily the storyline of the Chumash, and there's Midrash Halakha, following primarily the halachic content of the Midrash. What we're looking at is Midrash Halakha from the same time period as the Mishnah, and therefore the same rabbis who gave us the Mishnah are the rabbis who gave us the Mechilta and the other Midrashei Halakha, the other halachic Midrashim. And as far as the literary history is concerned, there's a minor conundrum here. There's a minor problem as far as literary history is concerned about which came first, Midrash Halakha or Mishnah. The stuff, the material, which is in the Midrash Halakha that we're about to look at, is more or less identical with the stuff, with the material that's in the Mishnah, except that the Mishnah is organized in tractates, subject matter order. The Mechilta, the Midrashim, are organized in the order of the verses of the Torah. But the material largely overlaps and is largely the same material. And there are two possibilities here. Perhaps Torah Shebaal Peh was originally transmitted generation after generation in the form of Midrash and later was reorganized into Mishnah form. Or perhaps it's the other way around. Perhaps from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu through the generations, Torah Shebaal Peh was organized in Mishnah form. Every generation would teach the next generation, Torah Shebaal Peh, one subject at a time. And then later, maybe it was reorganized in the order of the Psukim. The Rishonim, as well as the contemporary historians, disagree on exactly this issue. Both opinions are out there. But the importance of the Mechilta, the importance of Midrash Halakha, is similar to the importance of a Mishnah or a Tosefta or a Brice. It's the same rabbis. Let's see what it says. Based on a verse, it follows always the order of the verses, to the bottom of page 34. Makeh ish vameit mot yumat. Says in the verse that if you strike someone and he dies, you kill someone, then you should be put to death. The death penalty comes from killing ish. Now, you know, the word ish in Hebrew is a little bit problematic. The word ish might mean man as opposed to woman, or the word ish might mean man as opposed to animal, in which case women are included. You know, like the English word man is also ambiguous in that sense. Certain languages distinguish carefully. Like Latin has vir for a masculine man and homo for man as opposed to animal. But Hebrew and English, it's a little bit ambiguous. So the Midrash says, Shemani af ben shmonu mashma. I hear from this verse that someone who kills a ben shmona, a baby born prematurely after 8 months of pregnancy, is intended. A premature baby is also an ish. A premature baby is also an ish. The premature baby is born after 8 months of pregnancy. Someone who kills it in the first day of life, guilty of the death penalty. That would be the implication of the verse. Anyone who kills an ish gets the death penalty. Premature babies maybe are also ish, the Midrash suggests. He just suggests. And now he's going to tell you, no, it's not true. No. Talmud Lomar, let's look more carefully at what is meant here. Makeh ish. The Torah talks about makeh ish. Ish is not anyone who is alive. Magid, the verse is telling us, Eino chayev, there's no death penalty. Ad sheyaharog ben kiyama, unless you kill someone who is viable. An ish is someone who is viable. An ish is someone who has expectation of continued life. Someone who has no expectation of continued life, like a premature baby. Back in those days, premature babies almost always died. Someone who has a human who has no expectation of continued life is not an ish. The word ish means a human who we expect to continue living, and his life was cut short by an act of murder. Now, think about it for a moment.
I'm just here. It's not the shmona which is important.
Correct. Because premature.
Nowadays, the shmona is completely viable.
Yes, today babies, premature babies. Today there was this photograph in the New England Journal of Medicine around 2 or 3 months ago of a premature baby who at birth weighed 160 grams. There was a photograph of this baby. Well, actually, they didn't show the baby. The photograph just showed the nurse's hand, and the hand of the baby over part of the fingernail of the nurse. The whole baby's hand occupied a small part of the fingernail of the nurse. This photograph had been taken 3-4 years ago. That baby is now alive, growing alive and well. Surfactant is what does it. There's a medicine which they inject into the lungs, right? That's the single greatest advance. Who cares? Here's the issue. Imagine for a moment an adult person who's sick, about to die. That's in Gemara terminology, trefa. You know, like we normally think of trefa as being cows, right? But trefa means sick in a way that you're going to die soon. That's what trefa means. Normally we talk about cows being trefa. But humans can also be trefa. Now, if the human is trefa, if the human is someone who's going to die soon, has some kind of fatal disease, and you walk up to that person and stab that person and kill him, the question arises, we knew that person was about to die anyway. He was suffering from a fatal disease. Someone stabbed him in the heart. Why did he die? Did he die because of the stab in the heart? Maybe. But we knew he was about to die anyway from who knows what, cancer of this, cancer of that. Maybe he died, maybe he just happened to die from the disease he was going to die from anyway, and he just happened to die at the same time that someone stabbed him in the heart. Well, if we know that the victim was about to die anyway, there's no way to prove that the perpetrator is really responsible for the murder. And if you can't prove that he's responsible for the death, so there's no way to impose the death penalty, is there? Now, this is all before modern science, of course.
Yes, there is. The next thing we're talking about is the process, and the prohibition against even closing an eyelid, yeah. You're a good sayer.
Might.
He's ready to die. He's
maybe.
In the process of dying.
Yeah.
I guess you can impose the death.
Yeah. Even though the Gemara says that Goses Doma Lener HaMetaftef, and anyone who closes the eyes is Ki'ilu Rotzeach, that's only Ki'ilu Rotzeach, as though similar to a murderer. We wouldn't give the death penalty there. The Tosafot does have a situation. The Tosafot gave some thought to it back in those days and came up with a situation where we really could impose the death penalty. You know, the brain, the human brain, is surrounded by a membrane. According to the Gemara, it's a double membrane. There are two layers to the membrane. Modern physiology textbooks say there are three. There are three layers to the membrane, but one of them is microscopic, so it's not mentioned in the Gemara. And a trefa, well, one of the things that makes a cow trefa is a puncture of the dural membrane, a puncture of that membrane around, it's called the Kurum HaMoach in Hebrew. So the Tosafot suggests the following scenario. What happens if we take a living person, a healthy person, remove the skull, thereby exposing the dural membrane surrounding the brain? We inspect that, we see that it's whole, and then the murderer comes and puts the knife through the brain, thereby killing him. Now we know there was no hole there prior to the stabbing, and now we can do a dissection on the rest of the body and determine there were no other diseases. Now we can know that the murderer actually killed a viable person. But if he stuck the knife in without first allowing inspection of the dural membrane, maybe there already was a hole there. How do you know? If the murderer stabbed someone in the heart, maybe there already was a hole in the heart there. How do you know? You know, according to the Gemara, a hole in the heart of the aorta, it sounds bizarre to modern ears, but going to the Gemara, a hole in the heart or a hole in the aorta does not make an animal trefa. They thought that was a survivable condition. In modern veterinary science, it's not a survivable condition. The pressure, the blood pressure in the heart and the aorta is so high that even a small hole, you die very quickly. So to say, well, let's not get bogged down in trefas. Let's concentrate here on the important point. If a baby is born prematurely and then someone walks up to it and kills it, no death penalty, because it's not an ish. In order to be an ish, the baby must prove its viability. And a premature baby has not proven its viability yet. In a moment we'll have to see how it goes about proving its viability. Well, if killing the newborn is not a death penalty case, all the more so must it follow that destroying the fetus is not a death penalty case. No possibility of murder there, since that's premature. You can't get any more premature than that. The baby hasn't even been born yet. Even if the baby has been born, still, killing it is not a capital case.
But it depends how you define premature.
Yeah, that's on the next page. Let's talk about that, because that's obviously the next issue we have to talk about. The Mishnah in Ohelot. Mishnah in Ohelot deals with the following question. Isha, a pregnant lady, she makshalele, is having some difficulty giving birth. Talk about vague expressions. I don't know what her difficulty is.
Never met a woman who didn't have difficulty giving birth.
She's having more than the ordinary difficulty, but exactly how to define that is up for grabs. Look, the maksha leled might mean she's in a life-threatening situation. Maybe that's what they mean. On the other hand, maybe what they mean is she's just having some difficulty. Just having some difficulty above and beyond the ordinary problems. Don't know. I don't know what the problem is here, but there's some problem. Okay? Now, what are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to do? Not what are you allowed to do. What are you commanded to do? You insert a knife into her womb and slice up the baby, slice up the fetus, you destroy the fetus, and you remove the fetus one limb at a time in order to alleviate the woman's koshi, in order to alleviate the difficulty in giving birth. That's an abortion. That's an abortion. If the woman is having difficulty, perform. That's how they did abortions in those days. Why? Because her life takes precedence over its life. The mother's life takes precedence over the fetus's life. Now, the Mishnah has a lot to say about whose life takes precedence over whose life when you have to make a choice, because everyone hopes that he or she will never get into the situation where you have to make the choice about who lives and who dies. But the Mishnah has a lot to say about how to decide who gets precedence in life-threatening situations. Here the Mishnah is teaching us her life takes precedence over the fetus's life. Unless Yatsa Rubo, unless the majority of the baby has been delivered. When the majority of the baby is out of the birth canal in the air of the world, when the majority of the baby has been delivered, ain't noginbo, you can no longer touch the baby, you can no longer harm the baby. She'ein dochin nefesh mirei nefesh, because the rule is you're never allowed to kill one person to save another. Now, this Mishnah is of critical importance. The Mishnah says that during pregnancy, the abortion is correct. You're supposed to perform an abortion if she has koshi, if she has some difficulty. We've not defined exactly what that difficulty is. We'll come to it. The rule commanding us to perform the abortion expires at the moment that the majority of the baby has been delivered. The key question here is why? What changed when the majority of the baby was delivered? And that is the key question. The baby became a nefesh. The baby became a person, a nefesh. At what point in time does a fetus change its status from not being a person into being a person? At what point in time does the fetus become a nefesh, a person? At the moment that the majority of the body has been delivered at the moment when the majority of the body is in the air of the world, avir ha'olam. That's the point of the Mishnah.
In our Chavrusa, we were wondering if that necessarily means with visible signs of life or not.
Yeah, well, of course, if the baby's stillborn, then that's not a living person.
Well, sometimes babies come out
not breathing.
Right.
It takes a moment for them to start breathing.
Or they need to do something to...
Yeah, it's all upset, but even if the baby's not breathing, it's still attached to the umbilical cord and still has a heartbeat and still has plenty of signs of life. Okay? Right, babies have heartbeats even before they start breathing.
So then the answer is yes, they have to have signs of life.
Yeah, if it's stillborn, it's not alive.
Then as the sources will continue on, which you still have to define as being a viable life.
Yeah, this is going to come to also. Now, but we've learned something of critical importance. If the fetus becomes a nefesh, if the fetus becomes a person at this point in time, when the majority has been delivered, we are forced to the conclusion that before that, the baby is not a fetus, not a person. The fetus is not a person. That's the only conclusion that flows from this Mishnah. Fetuses are, as far as the Mishnah is concerned, a fetus is not a person. And just as there's no possibility of the death penalty for cutting off someone's finger or removing a kidney, so there can be no death penalty for destroying a fetus. A fetus is part of the mother. Now, of course, in general, you're not allowed to go around injuring people. In general, you're not allowed to go around harming people. In general, you need a good reason why you want to cut off someone's finger. In general, you need a good reason why you want to remove someone's kidney. But you don't need a life-saving reason. All you need is a good reason. If you have a good reason why someone's quality of life will be improved, if you remove this or remove that from the body, go for it. You don't necessarily need a life-threatening reason to perform surgery. It's enough to have a good reason. The dentist says that as the child is growing, the jaw is too small and the teeth are too crowded, and this child is going to have great dental difficulties as it grows older unless we remove one or two teeth to make more room along the jaw. Well, we're not talking about saving the kid's life, but we have a good reason to extract a tooth. That's all you need is a good reason. You don't need a life-saving reason. Okay?
To improve the shidduch possibilities.
Oh. Oh, what if it's a boy? We don't care what boys look like. You got the idea? According to this Mishnah, abortions are commanded in life-threatening situations. Well, in cases of koshi, which might mean life-threatening situations, but all you need is a good reason to perform the abortion, according to this line of reasoning. So far, so good? Let's go one step further. The Gemara in Nida. Gemara in Nida talks about Tinok ben Yomachad, a newborn. A newborn, one day old, first day of life. A newborn baby. And the Gemara says, Hahorgo chayiv. Anyone who kills the newborn baby gets the death penalty. Newborn baby, walk up to the baby, kill the baby, you get the death penalty for that. That's murder. First day of life.
So it's not after 24 hours.
Correct. First day of life. As soon as it's born. Yeah. I mean, the Gemara is going to change its mind in the next two lines, but at the moment, that's what the Gemara is thinking. The reason is, Dichtiv, it says in the Pasuk, Ve'ish ki yakeh kol nefesh adam mot yumat. It says in the Pasuk, you kill any person, you get the death penalty. The baby in its first day of life, the majority has been delivered. Right, the majority of the babies, the whole baby's been delivered. From the moment the majority of the baby has been delivered, anyone who destroys the life of the baby is guilty of murder. Then the Gemara says, come on, with whom does this opinion agree? Whose opinion is this? Deloka Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, this is surely not the opinion of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, and in fact it's no one's opinion. no one can hold this. And look at what Reb Shimon ben Gamliel taught us. Reb Shimon ben Gamliel said, "Kol sheshachah shloshim yom ba'adam eino nefel." Nefel is a stillborn baby. The baby which survives, shahat, the baby which survives for 30 days is not a nefel, is not a stillborn baby. That's what Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said. Let's think about that for a moment. Sometimes, unfortunately, babies are born dead. That's a nefel, a stillborn baby. What happens if a baby is born alive, takes two or three breaths, and then dies? Is that called a stillbirth, or is that called a live birth? According to Rabbi Shimon, in order for the baby to leave the category of stillbirth, it must prove its viability by living 30 days. If the baby has lived 30 days, it has proven its viability. Prior to 30 days of life, there's still the possibility of a stillbirth. Stillbirth is not the baby born, nephil is not necessarily the baby born dead. If the baby dies a few minutes later, it's still called a stillbirth. A day later, 2 days later, 3 days later, there has to be some cutoff point. And the cutoff point, according to Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, is 30 days of life. 30 days demonstrates viability. Holoshaha, if the baby did not live 30 days and is killed within the first 30 days of life, there's no way to know whether the baby would have lived 30 days. Maybe it was a stillbirth. Maybe it had this halakhic status of never being alive at all. No death penalty until the baby lives 30 days.
Doesn't that contradict the concept of once the baby's part way out, you need to choose one life
or
the other?
Yeah, sure, it does. It does. And we're going to deal with this also. We're going to deal with this also. It's all going to work out at the end. Hacha b'maya skinen. What are we talking about here? We're talking about dekim leshakalu chadashev. We're talking about a case dekim that we are standing there. We know shakalu lechadashev. We know that his months are finished. That means we're talking about a baby whom we know to be a full gestation, a full term baby after 9 months of pregnancy. Now, how is it possible to know whether a full 9 months, day to day, hour to hour. How can you know whether a full 9 months have passed from the moment of conception to the moment of birth? Well, in general, you cannot know, because in general, it's difficult, impossible to establish an exact moment of conception, except in the unusual case where a husband and wife are intimate together exactly one time after she goes to the mikveh, and then he travels abroad to another country for a few months and comes back and his wife is pregnant, so we know the exact moment when conception occurred. Aside from this unusual case, it's hard to know, it's impossible to know whether or not a full 9 months of pregnancy have elapsed, and therefore, in general, the halacha will assume that we don't know, except in the bizarre case where we know that the baby had full 9 months of pregnancy. If we know the baby had full 9 months of pregnancy, the person who kills it on the first day of life gets the death penalty. A baby born after a full 9 months of pregnancy does not have to prove its viability. After 9 months of pregnancy, we presume that the baby is viable until proven otherwise. Premature babies, on the other hand, must prove their viability, and every baby must be thought of as possibly premature unless you have proof regarding the moment of conception. So in general, babies are going to need 30 days of life in order to prove their viability.
Does that mean that for a pigeon event where you know it's for sure 9 months, you wouldn't wait a month to do the pigeon event?
No, there are other reasons for that, which we're not going to get into. The other reasons. Okay, what we've seen up till this point is a range of sources which more or less fit together but leave a number of important open questions. And what we're going to want is the guidance of the great poskim, to point us to exactly which elements in all the sources we've seen, exactly which elements are embraced by the great poskim, and if we can see which elements in the sources we've seen up to this point, which elements are embraced by the great poskim, then we'll be able to draw concrete conclusions. For this, we have to look at the Rambam. Rambam says like this: Ach zu mitzvat lo taseh. There's a negative commandment in the Torah. That's a complicated way of saying there's a prohibition in the Torah. The Torah prohibits us from having mercy on the life of the rodef, on the life of the pursuer. Everyone knows the rodef situation. Everyone knows the rodef, the pursuer scenario. You have three people, A, B, and C. A is the observer who sees that B is pursuing C, the victim, trying to kill him or kill her. And well, you're not allowed to have mercy on the life of the pursuer. You have to try to save the victim. If you can save the victim by less drastic means, you have to use less drastic means. But if the only way to save the victim is to kill the pursuer, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to not have mercy on the life of the pursuer. Lefichach, therefore, horu hachamim, therefore the rabbis instructed us, Sha'ubra, the pregnant lady, Shumakshalele, the pregnant lady who is having difficulty in birth. Again, we wonder whether this difficulty is a life-threatening one or not. The lady who's having difficulty in birth, Mutar, Lachtoch, Ha'ubar b'me'ea. It is permissible to perform an abortion by slicing up the fetus in her womb. You notice right away that he's following almost word for word the text of the Mishnah at the top of the page, with one major change. According to the Mishnah, we are commanded to perform the abortion to save the woman's life. According to the Rambam, mutar, we are permitted to perform the abortion to save the mother's life. In any event, a Torah observant Jew such as myself surely is strongly in favor of secular law in whatever country I live in, surely in favor of secular law which will permit abortions, since there are times when it's halachically correct to do it. And therefore, since there are times when it is halachically correct to perform an abortion, I want to live in a country where the secular law permits doing what
motivated the Rambam to downgrade.
Oh, we're going to see. You perform the abortion, ben basam, ben biyad. The abortion can be performed medically or surgically. There are medicines which will induce the abortion, or a surgical intervention will do it. And why? Because the fetus is like a pursuer threatening the life of the mother. But once the head of the baby was delivered, you can no longer harm the baby once the head has been delivered, once the head is in the air of the world. You can't kill one person to save another. This is the nature of the world. Now, there are several problems in this Rambam. The first problem we noticed, he seems to deviate from the opinion of his source, changing a required abortion into a permissible one. But that's not the only problem here. What other problems do you perceive? Majority of birth to the head, right?
It's not a problem, but it's a curiosity that he ends with this phrase, Zehu Tivu
Shalom. What are those words doing at the end of this halacha? Zehu Tivu Shalom, who cares? I mean, well, what is this doing?
What does it mean, the first part, the second part, or the whole thing?
I don't know, and what's it doing here? But there's a bigger problem. He introduced the problem of Rodef. Now think about it for a moment. The Rodef principle, the pursuer principle, is a very powerful principle. It's hard to imagine a more powerful principle anywhere than the Rodef principle. The Rodef principle tells us to kill someone to save someone else.
Not merely that it's mutter to do it, but
that's what we're supposed to do. Now think about it for a moment. You don't need the Rodef principle to tell you to save a human who is being threatened by a dog. You don't need the Rodef principle to tell you that. You need the Rodef principle to tell you to kill a person to save a person. Right? It makes no sense at all to introduce the Rodef principle unless the person we're killing is a person. You don't need the Rodef principle to kill an animal to save a person. You need the power of the Rodef principle to kill a person to save a person. According to the Rambam, the fetus is a person, which flies in the face of everything we've learned up till now. The fetus is a person. I mean, only a person can be a Rodef. A dog, you don't need any fancy principles to tell you that you kill a dog to save a person. Right?
This I'll call it this diuk that you're making, the Rambam. Who were the first to point this out?
The Igus Moshe on the next page. He was the first. And he draws the opposite conclusion. We'll come to it. Now further, let me tell you about difficulties in childbirth. Back in those days, one of the big problems in childbirth, well, still today, one of the problems is, sometimes, babies are supposed to be the head at the bottom, the feet at the top. That's the normal thing. You can feel through the wall of the womb, you can feel where the head is, and you feel where the feet is. Baby has to be positioned head down, feet up. The reason for that is that the head of the baby is the biggest part of the baby, and therefore delivery of the head is the most difficult part of the delivery. If the head has been successfully delivered, everything is easier after that. I mean, it's the rest is relatively easy compared to delivery of the head. Now, sometimes the babies are reversed. Sometimes you have the babies with the head at the top and the feet at the bottom. And this is a problem. The reason it's a problem, you have to put yourself back in the old days before they had ultrasound, before they had sonograms. Back in the old days, if the head was at the top and the feet were at the bottom, I mean, the feet are going to come out first. If the feet come out first, you run the risk of what they call in the business cephalopelvic disproportion. What happens if the cephalus, the head, is larger than the pelvic opening? If the head is larger than the pelvic opening, cephalopelvic disproportion. Doctors talk in a way that ordinary people can't understand, but that's all they mean, right? They just mean the head is too big to be delivered. Well, if the head is too big to be delivered, the baby's going to be stuck in the birth canal, just not going to come out. It's just too big to make it through the opening. And that's a problem. That's a big problem. Now, back today, there are a number of solutions, medical solutions for the problem, but still they prefer not to deliver babies in this way. There are many reasons. Back in the days of the Rambam, back in the days of antiquity, the only solution to this problem was for the midwife to take a mallet. A mallet is like a hammer, right? Take a hammer, crack the woman's pelvic bones, and if you crack her pelvic bones, then you can expand the opening a little bit, and the baby can be delivered. That was the only known solution for this problem in those days. Now,
under heavy sedation.
which they didn't have. This is before ether was developed. Now, Koshi. That's a difficulty in giving birth. Now the that's the problem. Now, of course, once the head has been delivered, and that's what the Rambam emphasizes, once the head has been delivered, everything is easier after that. Zehu tivro shel olam. It's a fact of nature. It's a fact of nature that once the head has been delivered, everything else is going to work out okay after that. It's the delivery of the head, which is the difficult part in delivery. Once the head is out, everything else is easier than that. That's a fact of nature. Zehu tiv'o shel olam. Now we're left with the problem that the Rambam seems to be saying that the Rodef principle applies here. He doesn't seem to be saying, he says it. And therefore, we're forced to the conclusion that the fetus is a person, and that flies in the face of everything we've learned so far, so we're left with a big problem. Okay? Well,
what does he mean by mutar?
Yeah, well, mutar, we're also left with that problem. Okay, so what we're going to do is pause with this cliffhanger, and in Yirtzeh Hashem, tomorrow we'll finish up.
Tomorrow. We can take a little bit.
Watch the next video.
I want to give you time to think about it. I want to give you time to think about the problems, and if you think about it, you might come up with some solutions yourself. Okay?
Okay.